We have, from the time we started studying the writing prophets, from the time of Joel on, as we've worked through both the minor and major prophets down now to Ezekiel, we have seen many similarities in the message of these various prophets. Each has a distinctive emphasis, which we've sought to point out as we've gone along, and yet they each overlap the other and show a real relationship here of the authorship of the Holy Spirit bringing His message through the various prophets at various times to various segments of His people. Ezekiel is distinctive in several ways, and yet we'll see that much of his message is basically what we have seen before. But it's put in a new aspect, put in a new slant for us, and is one of the most interesting revelations in many respects. It's also quite difficult in many ways, as anyone will agree who's read even the first chapter of the book. When I took a course in Ezekiel some years ago, the professor wouldn't even touch the first chapter. He just left it alone. He said he didn't know what it meant. He didn't think anybody else did, and he just went on from there. We'll try to do a little bit more with it than that, though I would not claim that I fully understand the impact of this first chapter. In your outline that I have given to you, you'll note that Ezekiel is identified as a priest. This is in the verse 3 of the first chapter. He also mentions here the 30th year, and we're not certain just what is meant by that, from what date he's dating. It may be his own 30th year when he was 30 years of age. It does not seem possible, the context here, that it could be the 30th year of captivity. At least if the 30th year here in verse 1 is to be identified with the 5th year of King Jehoiachin's captivity. So we're not certain, possibly his age is meant here. The river Kabar, we've already mentioned before, it was a canal really near the city of Babylon. We note then that God reveals himself to Ezekiel particularly by visions. Now in the content of the outline, and let's look at the outline just so we see something of the overall content of the book first before we move into its message. I've divided, as you can see, the content into two basic parts with a brief historical insertion in the middle. The first part of the book is the revelation which he had and gave to God's people before the fall of Jerusalem. Then we have the account of the fall. The news reaches Ezekiel in Babylon, as this is recorded in the latter part of the 33rd chapter. And then beginning with the 34th chapter, we have the prophecies after the fall of Jerusalem. You see in the content of this revelation, first of all, this vision of chapter 1, a vision of divine glory, certainly it is that above everything else. Then we have the call of Ezekiel in the next two chapters, and we see Ezekiel doing something that we've seen Isaiah and Jeremiah do a little bit, and that is portray certain prophecies, acting out before the people certain prophecies as a sign to the people. We'll see Ezekiel do this frequently. You'll notice I have enumerated several portrayals here. Then there are certain prophecies that are interrelated in the book. For instance, the prophecy of the end of Israel in chapter 7, here in the outline F, and the prophecy against the South Jerusalem, outline P, are certainly to be related, as we shall see when we study them. G and H, the visions of the sin of Jerusalem and of the East Gate, are also interrelated. The words to the elders of Israel in K and later on in O are also related. You'll see four parables. For instance, L and M, Q and R here both deal with parables. And we will note also a certain relationship between this first section and the third section. Then, too, Ezekiel has the same type of prophecies against the nations which we saw in most of the other prophets. In the third section, there is a clear relationship between the message to the mountains of Israel in chapter 6 of the first section and here in chapter 36. And certainly F, the vision of the new temple, is closely to be related to chapters 8 to 11 by way of contrast. So you see that there is a real interrelationship and a tying together between the sections. Now, with that very brief overview of the whole, let's look more in detail at the prophecy itself. The first section, as we've noted, deals with revelations before the fall of Jerusalem. And I have titled the first vision here to be a vision of God's hand in man's history. I said that above all it's a vision of the glory of God. Described in verses 4 following, I looked and behold a stormy wind out of the north, a great cloud with a fire enfolding itself. And out of the midst of it the likeness of four living creatures. They had the likeness of a man. Every one had four faces. Verse 9, they went every one straight forward. As for the likeness of their faces, they had the face of a man, the face of a lion, the face of an ox, and the face of an eagle. Verse 12, they went every one straight forward. Whither the Spirit wants to go, they went. As for the likeness of the living creatures, their appearance was like burning coals of fire, like the appearance of torches. Verse 15, now as I beheld the living creatures, behold, one wheel upon the earth beside the living creatures for each of the four faces. The appearance of the wheels and their work are here described. And there were, as it were, a wheel within a wheel. When they went in their four directions. As for their rims, they were high and dreadful. They four had rims full of eyes round about. And when the living creatures went, the wheels went beside them. When the living creatures were lifted up, the wheels were lifted up. Wherever the Spirit was to go, they went. For the Spirit of the living creature was in the wheels. Now, this first part of the vision here tells us of four living creatures and has a close parallel with Revelation 4. If you have studied the book of Revelation, this is very familiar to you. You remember in the book of Revelation in chapter 4, in the scene of heaven with all of its glory, we have there the evident appearance of God the Father, His presence there, we have God the Holy Spirit, and we have also the four living creatures, and we have also the 24 elders, which symbolically, apparently in the book of Revelation, do represent God's people, both in the Old and the New Testament eras. The 12 tribes of the Old, symbolic of the Old Testament church. The 12 apostles of the New, symbolic of the New Testament church. The 24 elders. So in Revelation 4, we have a scene that seems to portray the glory of heaven and the presence of the three persons of the Trinity there and of the church. In that context, as I understand it, the four living creatures I understand to represent four manifestations of Christ in His humanity. That is, Christ in His redemptive work. The face of a man, the humanity itself. The face of a lion, His kingship. The lion of David is frequently mentioned, and even in the book of Revelation there, He's identified as the Lion of David. The ox, representative of the sacrificial offering for the sins of people. The eagle representing the resurrection, the resurrected body. I don't have time really to go into the book of Revelation with you. I've been teaching that at the First Church, but that doesn't help you much. But there are reasons for identifying each of these figures with an aspect of the redemptive work of Christ. If that be so for Revelation, it seems that it may also be so here. But we should not bog down ourselves with this at this point. The overall impact of this is that the four living creatures, as they move, as they are active, so the wheels are active, and the wheels are subject to their movement and move with them. Now, we note that verse 15 tells us that the wheel, one wheel, reaches unto the earth. It's upon the earth. And you may recall in the first part of this revelation, in verse 4, we have a picture of a stormy wind out of the north and of a fire enfolding itself. Now, trying to put all of this together with what we've already seen in the revelations of the prophecies, we know that the north means the invading powers. We've seen this over and over. The north represents the nations that come down and sweep across God's people. We've seen fire over and over by the prophets used as symbolic of judgment, of God's judgment against the nation. Now then, it would seem, in trying to put these things together, that this vision is portraying for us in vivid portrait here a picture of what the prophets have been saying, that the things that happen on earth, the invasions from the north, the fire that consumes and judges the nations and even reaches to Israel and Judah, that this is under the control of God, that what happens on earth is what's determined in heaven, thus the wheel that reaches down to the earth, as it were, moving things on earth as God wills them. Now, I don't think that this is a far-fetched interpretation, because I've tried to base it on what we've already seen. And it seems to me that the message here is meaningful in this respect. And if that isn't what it means, then I don't know either. We have here, then, a relationship. Verse 19, when the living creatures went, the wheels went. And this, you see, would affect the earth, because the wheels reach down to the earth. When the living creatures are lifted up, the wheels are lifted up. They're under the control. The spirit of the living creatures is in the wheel. God moves in what is happening in this world. That we know is true. And I think that is the meaning of this vision. Now, the latter part of this vision, chapter 1, verses 22 following, over the head of the living creature, a firmament. And then verse 24, I heard the noise of great wings like the noise of the great waters, like the voice of the Almighty. Verse 26, and above the firmament, over their heads, that is, of the living creatures, the likeness of a throne, the appearance of sapphire. And upon the likeness of the throne, the likeness as the appearance of a man upon it above. And I saw as it were glowing metal in the appearance of fire. And so forth. The bow is seen in verse 28. And this was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. Now here we know then that this latter part shows then the throne of God. And then underneath that throne, a firmament, an expanse. And then underneath that, the wheels, the living creatures, and the wheels under them reaching down to the earth. So that really what you have is the throne of God. And then you have what we can call an expanse, or here it's called the firmament. You have the four creatures. And then you have the wheels reaching down to the earth. So this again shows that all is in the proper line and in the order and in the control of God. God on his throne, the earth down here, there is a relationship between the two. The God on his throne, the Lord of glory, is in control of things on earth. And this would be an important message for the children of God to receive in a time when they have been led away into captivity. You remember we said when we surveyed this period that one of the great problems the prophets like Ezekiel and Daniel and Jeremiah had was to convince the people that when they went into captivity, this did not mean that their God had been defeated. And so it seems quite needful that the people be reminded at the beginning of this revelation through Ezekiel that God is in control, that what is happening on earth is in God's hands, that this invasion is not just something that God could not protect his people from, but it's part of God's plan, as we've seen other prophets say also. Now the next section is the call of Ezekiel himself. And we have first use here of the address, Son of Man. Now this address, Son of Man, given to Ezekiel here is unique in the Old Testament with Ezekiel. But we do find in the New Testament that it's a term frequently used for Christ. He uses it as a favorite term for himself. He tells us his call. God says in verse 3, I send thee to the children of Israel, to the nations rebellious that have rebelled against me, and their fathers transgressed against me. And immediately we see a close relationship between the call of Isaiah and Jeremiah, because you remember that both Isaiah and Jeremiah were told in their calls that the people would rebel, the people would not hear. Now Ezekiel is one with them in this particular task that is his. Verse 5, he insists that though they are a stiff-necked and impudent people, yet shall they know there has been a prophet among them. And thou, son of man, be not afraid, neither be afraid of their words. This is also a reminder of Jeremiah 1, you recall, where God said the same thing to Jeremiah, do not be afraid. He goes on in verse 8 following to repeat the warning that Ezekiel should not be rebellious. You, son of man, hear what I say and do not be rebellious. Open your mouth and eat that which I give thee. The roll of the book was therein, and it was written within and without, and there were written lamentations and mournings and woe. And he says, I ate, and it was in my mouth as honey for sweetness. So this again reflects something we see in the book of Revelation, for instance, in chapter 10 in particular, the book of Revelation. John is commanded to eat, and then after he's eaten, he tells us that it was sweet in the mouth but bitter in the stomach, and then he is given the command to go out and preach the gospel, continue to proclaim God's word. I would understand a similar meaning here in Ezekiel, that he is being given here a message. A message that is truly sweet to God's people. But, as is said in the book of Revelation, it's bitter in that there is a sharing in the suffering of Christ, and the suffering identifying yourself with God's people and with God brings on a certain suffering in your life. Now, Ezekiel is sent to Israel. Verse 4, get thee to the house of Israel. I have not sent thee to a people of strange speech or of a hard language, but to the house of Israel, not to many peoples of a strange speech. Surely if I sent thee to them, they would hearken to thee, but the house of Israel will not hearken to thee, for they will not hearken to me. Now, I believe the New ASV has altered the translation here somewhat, reading quite the same, but I think that the reading that I have given you from the older ASV is the more correct. That is, if I sent thee to them, they would hearken. That is, to other peoples of a strange tongue. We have a point of illustration. We have Jonah. God sent Jonah to Nineveh, and Nineveh did hearken. They did listen. And yet God's people have not listened. He describes them in verse 7 as of a hard forehead and of a stiff heart. Pointing to the heart again reminds us of Jeremiah. You remember how much he had to say about the heart. It's hard-heartedness and corruption. Verse 10, "Moreover, he said to me, Son of man, all of my words that I speak to you, receive in your heart." Here we have the Deuteronomy 6 injunction again. Take it to heart. It's imperative then that the deliverer of the message of God be a man who's taken that message to his own heart. Now he tells us in verse 15, "I came to them of the captivity at Tel Aviv, and I sat there overwhelmed 7 days." When we get to Job, we'll see that Job's friends were overwhelmed when they saw how much he was tortured. And they just sat there in silence for days looking at him. Ezekiel must feel something of this same thing as he sits here in silence and in awe at the great message that God is beginning to reveal to him. Now in the latter part of this chapter, we have something that will also be further expanded in chapter 33, and there's a relationship between the two. Namely, God setting the prophet Ezekiel here as a watchman over Israel. "Therefore, hear the word of my mouth and give them warning. When I say to the wicked, thou shalt surely die, and thou givest him not warning, the same wicked man will die in his iniquity, but his blood will I require at thy hand. Yet, if thou warn the wicked, and he turn not, thou hast delivered thy soul. Again, when a righteous man turns from his righteousness, because thou hast not given him warning, he shall die in his sin, and his righteous deeds will not be remembered. But his blood will I require at your hand." So the concept here is that God makes Ezekiel responsible for giving the warning. Ezekiel is not responsible for converting the man. Make sure you understand that. He is responsible for teaching God's word. And this is just as true of the evangelist today. It is not our part to convert any man. Only God can convert. It is our responsibility to preach the gospel. It is our responsibility to tell men the truth. If we neglect to tell them what God has told us, then we are guilty. And we will be held accountable. "His blood I will require at thy hand." We don't know. We're not told what this means. But we know that it could not be good. "The hand of the Lord was upon me. He said, arise, go forth to the plain, and I will talk with thee there." And in the plain he saw again something of the glory of the Lord that he had seen in the first vision. And he's warned that he will be opposed by those to whom he goes. Verse 24, "Go shut thyself within thy house. Thou son of man, behold, they shall lay hands on thee and bind thee." Reminiscent of Christ's words to Peter. "Peter, they'll lay hands on you and bind you, take you where you wish not to go." And in reality, any committed servant of Jesus Christ must expect this, that when he identifies with his Lord, he identifies himself as an enemy of the world, and the world takes him just as that. Now in chapter 4, we have this first portrayal. By means of a portrayal, he is to convey here the siege of Jerusalem. He is to lie down with a tile, and he's to lie on one side and then the other, and he's to portray various aspects of the siege. And if you compare, for instance, Jeremiah 37, where we have the account of the actual siege of Jerusalem, you'll see how meaningful his acting out of that siege is here in chapter 4. An interesting aspect of it, in verse 5, "I have appointed the years of their iniquity to be unto thee a number of days, even 390 days, so shalt thou bear the iniquity of the house of Israel. 40 days, each day for a year, have I appointed it unto thee, and thou shalt set thy face toward the siege of Jerusalem with thine arm uncovered, and thou shalt prophesy against it." Now, what he was to do, evidently, was to act out the sure coming of the siege. And he's told to do it 390 days, and then apparently 40 other days, as we read here. Now, I don't think this means that he laid out there and did nothing except just lay there for all the time, but perhaps each day for 390 days he went out and laid himself on his side to act out, portraying here the sureness of this siege. Why 390? We're told that it's a day for a year. Why 390 years? Well, if you take from the time of this vision or this command, the year was about 592. Now, if you go back then 390 years before that, you come sometime about the middle of the 900s, which would be sometime around the time of Solomon. And it may be, you see, that the 390 days would be representative of the 390 years that the people have been disobedient since the time of Solomon and since the division of the kingdom and since all of that history, acting out day by day, year for year. If that be so, then perhaps the 40 days would represent the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness when again the people were extremely disobedient to God. It seems then that the portrayal here is to represent the reason why God must now judge Jerusalem and why the city is under siege and must fall. Because look at the long history emphasized here by his going out there day after day and laying on one side and then the other, portraying the tedious, long history of the people's disobedience against God. Verse 9, he also portrays scarcity here of food, something which is identified with the things that befall a city in siege. And he drinks his water by measure and eats his bread unclean, which is, again, pictures the circumstances in a time of siege. You remember that under siege, some of the mothers were actually boiling their children and eating them. So it again gives this picture of the terror of a siege. Chapter 5 is also very closely related, the portrayal of the desolation of Jerusalem. Here he takes a razor and shaves his head and balances up the hair into three piles, divides the hair, and a third is to be burned, a third is to be smitten with a sword, and a third is to be scattered to the winds. Again, acting out of what's going to happen to the people. Some of you are going to die by the sword. Some of you will die by the fire. Some of you will be scattered to the winds, thrown all over the ancient Near East. And then he seems to be symbolizing in verses 3 and 4 something of the remnant. Take a few in number and bind them in thy skirt. And even these, take some of them and cast them into fire, showing that the remnant must be purged. Fire will come and purge out all the dross in Israel. This we have seen over and over, the message of the prophets. Verse 10, therefore, fathers shall eat sons in the midst of thee. You remember that incident in 2 Kings 6:29. We were reminded of it in Jeremiah 19:9 also, the times of distress when the people actually eat their own children. So bad off are they. So in verse 12, he mentions here, we've seen a triple judgment of God before, inclusive of pestilence and famine and the sword. Now a fourth is mentioned here, the scattering to the winds, the captivity itself, and the carrying peoples off in verse 12. So really we have a quadruple judgment, the pestilence, the famine, the sword, and those scattered to the winds. Chapter 6 is a prophecy against the mountains of Jerusalem. You remember in Micah, in the last chapter of Micah there was the judgment scene with the mountains being the judge, the mountains of Israel being the judges there, and God was making his case before them. Now, interestingly, the message of this prophecy is directed toward the mountains of Israel. Here representative of the places where all of the sins of the people have been committed, the high places. Now we'll want to remember and compare what we read here with chapter 36, because in chapter 36 we have another message to the mountains, but it's quite different in its content from this one, in bold contrast to this one. verse 7, the slain shall fall in the midst of you, and you shall know that I am the Lord. Up above, he's described in dramatic pictures here, the slaying of the dead bodies lying all over the ground, their bones spread out. But note verse 7, you shall know that I am the Lord. You remember Hosea was so concerned that his message particularly dealt with this theme, the people do not know God. And because they do not know God, they fall under judgment. That meant that they did not have a saving relationship to God. They did not know Him as their Redeemer. And so, all of God's judgment against His people, all of His judgment against Israel and against the nations is that all should know that He is God. And we'll see this phrase repeated throughout in Ezekiel, ye shall know I am the Lord, the object of all the judgment of God against Israel. Here in verse 8, he begins again to give hope in terms of a remnant. Yet will I leave a remnant. Verse 9, those of you that escape shall remember me, how that I have been broken with their lewd heart. You remember that Jeremiah talked about the lewdness and sinfulness of the heart of the people. And the people must learn through punishment, through judgment, must come to learn their own sin and that their only hope is in God. This is what David learned. Look here in verse 9. They shall loathe themselves in their own sight for the evils they have committed. And they shall know that I am the Lord. I have not said in vain that I will do this evil to them. You remember that David came loathing himself in a contrite and broken heart. And God says that this must happen to every one of you if you are to be acceptable to me. Then verse 11, smite with thy hand and stamp with thy foot and say, alas. Ezekiel was quite a gesture. You can imagine the kind of gestures that he must have used. He portrayed out all kinds of things. And here he smites with his hand, stamps with his foot. I don't know how many of you know Dr. Gutsky, but he's a big man. And he used to use this verse often in emphasizing how when we preach, we've got to really show that we mean it. And he would smite with his hands and his one hand and take both of mine to make one of his. And his foot was equally big. And he'd come down with that foot and the whole room would vibrate. He got his point over. We go on then in chapter 7, the prophecy of the end of Israel. And the emphasis here is on the end. Verse 2, unto the land of Israel, an end, the end is come. Now is the end upon thee. The kingdom is at an end. The nation of Israel has come to an end. Its king will fall, its nation will fall. Thereafter there will be a people of Israel, a people of God, but the kingdom is at an end. You remember in Amos 8:2, in one of his visions, he saw a vision of the end. And this is parallel to that here. So the description in verse 7, a day of tumult and not of joyful shouting, reminiscent here of Joel's prophecy. Then in verse 14, they have blown the trumpet and made all ready. The trumpet sound again as Joel shows us the warning of the judgment to come. Wherefore I bring the worst of the nations, and they shall possess their houses. This is verse 24. And I will also make the pride of the strong deceased. Note the worst of the nations. You remember Habakkuk's problem. Lord, how can you judge your people by people who are worse than they are? God says, I'll bring the very worst against you. And as we noted in studying Habakkuk, that in God's sight there's no more righteous than another. All in their own righteousness are unrighteous in God's sight. In verse 26, they shall seek a vision of a prophet, but the law will perish and counsel from the elders. There'll be no word from God in those days. They'll have to depend on what God has said in the past. Amos 8:11, you remember, said, "The days will come when I'll give you a famine, not of bread, but a famine of the Word of God." Now, chapters 8 to 10 give us a series of visions of the sins of Jerusalem. In the Spirit, Ezekiel is now lifted up and carried from his place in Babylon all the way to Jerusalem. Now, not in physical sense, but spiritually picked up, and in a vision, as it were, he's carried there. And these three chapters, 8, 9, and 10, tell us of what he saw there. We're told of the transportation of him here in verse 3. "The Spirit lifted me up and brought me in the visions of God to Jerusalem." And he comes to the temple, and he sees there the seat of the image of jealousy. And then in verse 5, the gate of the altar, this image of jealousy in the entry. Verse 6, even the great abominations that the house of Israel commit here. And then he warns in verse 6 at the last part, "Thou shalt again see yet other great abominations." So there's an image of jealousy. That is that which is put up against God. You remember God said, "I am a jealous God. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make unto you any graven images. I am a jealous God." Now they have made other, they brought other gods in. Great abominations. Verse 10, "I went in and saw, and behold, every form of creeping thing, an abominable beast, and idols portrayed upon the wall round about. And there stood 70 men of the elders of the house of Israel." Verse 12, "Then said he to me, Son of man, hast thou seen what the elders of the house of Israel do in the dark, every man in the chambers of his imagery," or of imagery. Then we go on in verse 14, "Then he brought me to the door of the gate of the Lord's house, and there sat women weeping for Tammuz," which is one of the gods of the Canaanites. And then in verse 16, "I went to the inner court of the Lord's house, and I saw there 25 men, their faces toward the east, worshiping the sun." God said, "Is it a light thing to the house of Judah? They fill the land with violence, provoke me, and I will therefore deal in wrath." Now, what was this experience of Ezekiel? What was it that he was seeing here? Well, I think we have a clue in verse 12. Every man, what he does, what it is like in his chambers of imagery. And then compare that with chapter 14, verse 3. Excuse me, verse 4. Well, 3 and 4. "Son of man, these men have taken their idols into their heart and put the stumbling block of their iniquity before their face. Every man of the house of Israel that taketh his idols into his heart and putteth the stumbling block of his iniquity before his face and comes to the prophet." Note here then that what Ezekiel apparently is seeing here is in vivid colors the hearts of the people. He's really seeing what it's like in the hearts. Idols, images drawn on the walls of the hearts, as it were, a people who in their hearts are given over to idolatry and to violence. Now God says then in chapter 8, "I'm going to judge." And then in chapter 9, the command, verse 4, "Go through the midst of the city, set a mark upon the foreheads of the men that sigh and that cry over all the abominations that are done in the midst thereof. And to the others he said in my hearing, Go through the city and smite, let not your eyes spare, nor have pity. Slay utterly old men and young, virgins, children and women, but come not near any upon whom the mark is, and begin at my sanctuary." Now this again is very reminiscent of the book of Revelation in chapter 7. There where the mark is called the seal of God on those who have put their trust in Him. Here, it's the mark of God on those who have groaned and sighed and mourned for the abominations in the city. They reflect a heart that's not like the hearts that Ezekiel has seen. They reflect a heart that loves God and is hurt with the hurt that God feels at the disobedience of the people. As our Lord himself said in the Beatitudes, blessed are they that mourn. Blessed are those who are concerned for the sins all around them, whose hearts are broken, who feel with God the sinfulness of the people. They, God will protect. He says, begin at the house, at the sanctuary, at my sanctuary, reminding us of Amos 3, where we see the judgment of God beginning there indeed at the sanctuary. Or Jeremiah 25:29, which is similar to this passage here, but particularly 1 Peter 4:17, where Peter states it as a principle that judgment must begin at the house of the Lord. Judgment must begin with God's people. You see here something of the deep concern of Ezekiel in verse 8. I fell on my face and cried, Lord, wilt thou destroy all the residue? God's answer is, the iniquity of the house of Israel and Judah is exceeding great. You've seen it, Ezekiel. I've let you go in and look into their hearts. You've seen what they're really like. Now, chapter 10 is a repeat in some respects of what we saw in the first chapter. It shows us a contrast between the glory of God that was seen in that chapter and the absolute sinfulness of the people's hearts, as we have seen that in these recent chapters. Here, the four living creatures are described as cherubims. And we have again verse 18. Well, note the number of times the glory of the Lord is mentioned here. Verse 4, the glory of the Lord mounted. Verse 4 again, the Lord's glory. And again in verse 18, the glory of the Lord. In verse 19, the glory of the God of Israel. Over and over, the emphasis is on God's glory is over against, in contrast to the sinfulness of the hearts of the people. Verse 2 of chapter 11, as we move into a second series of visions, still as he's transported into Jerusalem, these are the men that devise iniquity and that give wicked counsel in this city. He's talking here about those false prophets in Jerusalem. You remember that Jerusalem was facing, that Jeremiah was facing those very prophets in Jerusalem. And Ezekiel is reminded that there are wicked prophets that prophesy wicked things right now in Jerusalem. Verse 5, I know the things that are coming to your mind. Ye have multiplied your slain in the city and filled the streets with the slain. Yes, God knows it. He just showed it to Ezekiel. He just showed Ezekiel what's in their hearts and in their thoughts. He says, I know it, and I'll judge it. Then as we move on, we have the cry of Ezekiel, you remember over here in chapter 9, verse 8, when he cried out, Lord, will you completely destroy? Now again, in verse 13 of chapter 11, Ah, Lord, wilt thou make a full end of the remnant of Israel? Well, God didn't really answer Ezekiel the first time, but now he does. And in verse 16 following, it says, Yet will I be to them a sanctuary, that is, to the remnant, for a little while in the countries where they are come. And I will gather you from the peoples and assemble you out of the countries, and I will give you the land of Israel. They shall take away the detestable things and all abominations. And I will give them one heart and put a new spirit within you. And I'll take the stony heart out of their flesh and give them a heart of flesh, that they may walk in my statutes and keep my ordinances and do them and be my people, and I will be their God. But as for them whose heart walks after the heart of their detestable things and their abominations, I will bring their way upon their own head. You see what he's saying here then is, for the remnant whom I've called, who have looked to me, I will purge them a little while, and then I will give them a new heart, just as Jeremiah said in Jeremiah 31. I'll clean their hearts. I'll renew them. But as for those whose hearts are like those I showed you, whose hearts are full of detestable things and abominations, I'll bring judgment on their head, on their heads. Just as he said in Isaiah 66. Just as he said in Amos 9, 8 following. Now we have at the end of chapter 11, the end of the vision in Jerusalem, which began in chapter 8. And we come now in chapter 12 to a portrayal of the captivity of Jerusalem. Here Ezekiel moves all of his stuff from one place to another. He just unloads his house, evidently, and just takes all of his baggage and lock, stock, and barrel, moves out, portraying as a sign, as God says in verse 6, I make you a sign to the house of Israel, a sign of exile, just as his other portrayals were signs of the siege. Now a sign of the exile. And just as he moved all of his stuff, so they'll have to move all of their stuff. Verse 18, acting out fear, eat thy bread with quaking and drink thy water with trembling. He acts out here again in a vivid way the terrors of captivity and of going into exile. Now in chapter 13, the message to the false leaders. Prophesy against the prophets of Israel that prophesy and say, prophesying out of their own heart. Notice the source of their prophecies. The same thing Jeremiah said, Jeremiah 14:14, 23:16, that false prophets prophesy out of sinful hearts. Verse 6, they have seen falsehood and lying divination. They've made men to hope that the word would be confirmed. In other words, you remember Jeremiah's problem, that there were false prophets saying that God won't judge Jerusalem, it will be delivered. Verse 10, because they have seduced my people, saying peace and there is no peace. A reminder of Jeremiah 8:11 or 14:13. The false message of peace. Thus he says, I will judge them. And so again in verse 17, set thy face against the daughters of thy people that prophesy out of their own heart. Women prophets also prophesying lies. Judgment against them also, according to chapter 13. Then in chapter 14, words to the elders of Israel who came to Ezekiel. There God says, now here they're coming. They're coming as though they were seeking my will from you, Ezekiel. But don't be fooled. You remember I showed you what their hearts are like in verse 4. Every man of the house of Israel that takes his idols into his own heart and puts the stumbling block of his iniquity before his face. Then we have in verse 10 an expression of God's true goal out of all of this exile. He says, they shall bear their iniquity, and the iniquity of the prophet shall be as the iniquity of him that seeks him, that the house of Israel may go no more astray from me, neither defile themselves, but that they may be my people, and I may be their God. And so the purpose of God, which we saw expressed in Exodus 19, to have a people, a holy people, will not be thwarted by the sinfulness of the many, but God will purge, and God will save his people. And there will be a people that will continue to be known as the people of God. And as we see the exile and the post-exilic period, we see that just this thing happens. Now he says, Son of Man, verse 13, when a land sins against me, and I stretch out my hand and break the staff of bread and send famine and cut off from it man and beast, though these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they should deliver but their own souls by their righteousness, saith the Lord. Now, these three men mentioned here, Noah, Daniel, and Job, are all men of God of ancient times. At least two of them are, Noah and Job, devout men. And yet, they themselves could not save Israel from judgment in this day. There's risen in recent days a questioning of the identity of Daniel. Some have argued that Daniel does not belong in this group because Daniel is recent. He's really contemporary with Ezekiel. and that there has not been time enough for his fame to be known, and that Noah and Job represent ancient people. And so out of the Ugaritic tablets, they have discovered a record of a Daniel that lived in ancient times, who apparently was a pagan. At least there's no identifying him with the people of God. And but yet he was known for his great wisdom and goodness in the ancient world. And some say that this is the Daniel that Ezekiel is talking about. My answer to that would be, particularly as we note in 28:3, there we have mention of Daniel again. Behold, thou art wiser than Daniel. There is no secret that is hidden from thee. Those words reflect so clearly the Daniel we know in the Bible. And if Ezekiel mentioned that Daniel in 28, then why not here? Seems to me that he is speaking of the Daniel we know from the Bible. Daniel is a recent man of God, well known to all the hearers here. Chapter, and again, after warning them that there will be judgment, he makes clear that nothing can thwart this judgment, not even Noah, Daniel, and Job. Then he goes on again to repeat this quadruple judgment of the beasts and swords and pestilence and fire and the famine, the various means by which God judges. Still promising a remnant, verse 22, yet there shall be left a remnant. Chapter 15 reminds us somewhat of Isaiah 5, the fruitless vine. You remember that parable of the vine and the vineyard would not bear fruit. And here he says, what use is such a vine but to be burned? And then chapter 16, reminding the people of their humble origins. Verse 3, thus says the Lord to Jerusalem, thy birth and thy nativity is of the land of Canaanite. The Amorite was thy father, thy mother was a Hittite. As for thy nativity, in the day thou wast born, verse 5, no, I pitied thee. A picture here of a helpless babe, naked, dirty, no one to care for it. The interesting point at this juncture is, thy father was an Amorite and thy mother a Hittite. Now, the relationship of the Amorites to the descendants of Israel or their forefathers is given to us, you remember, in Joshua 24, where Joshua there reminds them of the pagan background of Abraham's people. As to the Hittites, there were Hittites living there, and there were certain intermarriages that we know of. For instance, Uriah, and Uriah was a Hittite. His wife, maybe, we don't know. Anyway, she was David's wife later on, and there was certainly apparently a tie-in there with the Hittites. That there were Hittites in the land, we know, that there were intermarriages, we know. And this is, again, showing them something of the humble origins of their own background. Then a picture of their pitiful state. You are helpless. In Hosea 11:1, you remember, God said, when Israel was a child and I loved him. And God is saying the same thing here. You were helpless and nobody was concerned for you, and I loved you. Verse 6. When I passed by and saw thee weltering in thy blood, I said unto thee, live, and I caused thee to multiply. And you increased and waxed great and grew. And then he says, I took you unto me as my own. And here we come to the Hosea theme as the church, the bride of the Lord. And then he goes on again with the Hosea theme to the faithlessness of this one whom he had taken. In verse 15, but thou didst trust in thy beauty, playedst the harlot because of thy renown, and pouredst out thy whoredom. Here again, the theme that Hosea dealt with in the first three chapters, as you recall. Verse 26, he will warn them against the foreign alliances that they made. Thou hast also committed fornications with the Egyptians, provoking me to anger. And you remember that this started in Solomon's day. So it seems to me that really God does reach all the way back to the time of Solomon in that tracing of the 390 years of the faithlessness of the people. Verse 30, how weak is thy heart? Here again, a summation of what Jeremiah says in his message. Verse 35, therefore, harlot, hear the word of the Lord. Because of thy filthiness and nakedness, therefore I will judge. And then he goes on as in the same vein that Hosea spoke of that judgment and portrays it in like manner. Then as he moves toward the end of chapter 16, again he strikes on the new covenant mentioned earlier. Nevertheless, in verse 60, I will remember my covenant with thee in the days of thy youth, and I will establish an everlasting covenant. Then shalt thou remember thy ways and be ashamed, and I will give them to thee for daughters. I will establish my covenant, and thou shalt know that I am the Lord, when I have forgiven thee all that thou hast done. So Ezekiel, you can see, has moved toward the same kind of solution that we saw in Isaiah and Jeremiah. The answer is not in the people. They can't do anything to change themselves. They're totally reprobate, sinful in heart. God, therefore, will bring them to the point of recognizing their need of God, their sinfulness, and then he will forgive. As he says in Isaiah 40, your sins are forgiven and washed away.